The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today's guest is author of the number one best-selling book, Wheat Belly. He's Dr. William Davis. He's a cardiologist based in Milwaukee, and he has really revolutionized our view of how to get healthy with his wheat belly paradigm. And it goes way beyond just simple avoidance of wheat, as we discussed in part one. But an important question, and I know you address this question extensively on your website, where you're very generous. You have a lot of tips and suggestions. There's a real community there where people can ask questions and interact. Is how do you survive wheat withdrawal? I've seen it in my patients. It's a combination of wheat withdrawal and carbohydrate withdrawal, and people kind of go through conniptions. So many tips for undertaking that journey.
Sure. It really is something, isn't it? People often are skeptical it's going to happen until they experience it. And it's a very real phenomenon. Not everybody gets it. Only about half the people who do this get it. And if you don't get it, that's good. It's not, doesn't mean you've done something wrong. We don't know why it doesn't happen to everybody. But it is really what looks like an opiate withdrawal syndrome. It's nausea, headache, fatigue, depression. People can't exercise. They feel awful. I've seen people rolled up in balls, incapacitated by it. It lasts about a week. It can be short. It can be just a day or two. It can be 2 or 3 weeks for some people, but the most common experience is about a week. So I tell people be aware of this because if you don't understand what it is, you might say something silly like, it must be my body telling me I need wheat or grains. It's not that. No more than stopping cigarettes with its withdrawal syndrome is your body telling you need cigarettes. You don't need cigarettes, of course. It's just a withdrawal syndrome. And so there are some common sense steps people can take. I tell people try, if at all possible, to choose a less stressful week. So if you're on a deadline 4 days, that's probably not a good time to do it. So try. No one has a stress-free life, of course, but try to pick a somewhat less stressful period of time. Try to do nice things for yourself. Get a massage. Watch a fun movie. Don't exercise. I tell people this is like trying to exercise when you have the flu. I mean, there's no benefit, and you feel horrible. So the most you might want to do is a casual thing like a casual walk, casual bike ride. But hard exercise is simply counterproductive. Hydrate. It's very important to hydrate because when weight loss starts, let's say you lose 5 pounds the first week, which is a very common result. And by the way, we're not talking about restricting calories here. I want people to eat more and add more fat to their diet and not push the plate away, none of that nonsense. But people lose about 5 pounds the first week, of which about 2 pounds is water. So there is a diuretic effect, a water loss effect in that first week in particular, but it can make you very lightheaded. It happens so quickly. So I ask people to hydrate more than usual. When insulin drops, as it does when you do this, and you lose that gliadin protein, blood insulin levels drop, and you stop retaining salt. And so people lose a lot of their salt sensitivity, and it helps to lightly salt your food. So that really helps lightheadedness too. People who take blood pressure medicines and blood sugar medicines for diabetes need to talk to their doctors about dropping or even stopping their medication quite quickly.
Adjusting, because you can overshoot with your blood pressure and blood sugar management.
Absolutely. And both can be quite dangerous, especially low blood sugars. So people who take insulin, for instance, typically have to cut their insulin doses by 50% in the first few days and then even more long term. And likewise, some of the diabetes drugs, particularly glyburide, glimepiride, and glipizide, that can cause dangerous hypoglycemia, low blood sugars.
And not so much metformin, though. Possibly metformin might be better tolerated.
Exactly, that's right. So metformin, it's uncommon, when used alone at least, to have hypoglycemia. But regardless, people should know that they should talk to their doctors, because we don't want abnormally low blood. I've had people pass out, actually. We don't want that to happen, and we don't want people having low blood sugars, and they can be very dangerous. So, but don't let this seem like a bad thing. This is a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have to reduce, of course, your blood pressure medicine or your blood sugar medicine, that's terrific, right?
Right. I sometimes say to patients, you know, it's a little bit like taking an elevator up to the top of the Empire State Building or the New World Trade Center. You feel the acceleration and it can be a little unpleasant, but once you get to the top, the view is great.
Very good.
So, yeah, people will go through some changes. Now, physiologically, you know, you explained a little bit what's happening, but is there literally, people are literally addicted to wheat because of the endorphins or the gliadopeptides that are in there that have an opiate-like effect? They're exorphins. Yeah. Excuse me. I used the wrong word. Exorphins.
You can actually mimic it by giving people opiate-blocking drugs like naloxone intravenous or naltrexone orally, and you can actually recreate the syndrome. Hmm. People get nauseated. They get headaches. They get depressed. It's only transient. It only lasts a week, just like you expect. And there are studies demonstrating this opiate-like effect. We do need better data. I think we should explore this further. It's one of the priorities on my list of things to explore more clinically and scientifically to further document this phenomenon. But it's quite clear there is an opiate withdrawal syndrome when you do this, and there's an addictive relationship with grain products, but especially wheat. Wheat seems to stand out as being the most dramatically associated with this. So I've had people sobbing in my office because they intuitively knew that if they didn't have something made of wheat for about 4 to 6 hours, they would start getting shaky and foggy and depressed. They knew they'd start having all these peculiar feelings. And so they knew when I told them, we're going to get rid of this stuff and you're going to have to live with that feeling for a while, they'd burst out into tears. They'd be sobbing. And those people, you know, have a real addictive relationship with wheat products. But once you bring it out in the open and let them know this is a real thing, this is not some internal weakness, this is not some weak-willed problem you've got. It's a real, it's an addiction like to alcohol or tobacco, except no one told you that this stuff was addictive. And, you know, think of it. We've been told to follow a diet low in fat and rich in healthy whole grains. It's essentially a diet guaranteed to create a nation of obese people.
Indeed. It certainly has backfired. So what can you eat? I mean, probably the most problematic meal is breakfast, because people traditionally have grains for breakfast. So what's a wheat belly type breakfast that's satisfying, that will carry you through hours and hours with satisfaction and fullness?
You know, the whole eat more healthy whole grain argument was really a response to the let's cut our fat, total fat, saturated fat, mm-hmm. and cholesterol first.
Dating back to Kellogg and Post in the 1800s. Yeah, the originators of cereals.
That's right. So I reject that notion also. We do not limit fat. We do not limit saturated fat. I mean, there are fats we do limit, of course, like trans fats, hydrogenated fats. But the real natural fats, like those on your steak or those in your eggs or the fat that comes off your bacon, we eat that. I tell people don't worry about fat. So we have lots of eggs for breakfast. We have meats for breakfast, including bacon, though I think the sodium nitrite issue is a real one. The data needs to be better, but I think there's enough evidence, particularly in animal models, that sodium nitrite reacts with meats the amine groups of meats when you heat them and become the nitrosamines. That data is pretty good. So we do try to get uncured meats. Mm-hmm. You're exactly right, though. We've eliminated a lot of staples, at least staples of the last century, like breakfast cereals and bagels and toast. And so you can recreate, by the way, all those things. It takes some effort at home. You have to make them yourself. You can recreate a grain-free granola. You can recreate grain-free breakfast cereals. You can recreate grain-free bread and toast it. Some people like to do that in the beginning. After a while, they realize they don't really need to do that. So I follow a rule of just eating real whole foods and also bringing dinner foods into breakfast. So it's okay to have a salad for breakfast. It's okay to have some meat and some vegetables for breakfast. We make a lot of muffins. We have lots of recipes for muffins, grain-free, of course, grain-free with no added sugar. The cookbooks are filled with these kinds of recipes. So there's lots and lots of things you can eat. Here's another little trick, a little kind of a nice benefit. If we take – this is what I do with a lot of my time now. We take recipes, say, for pizza or cheesecake. You know, pizza and cheesecake are not ordinarily thought of as health foods. But if we take, let's say, pizza, and we take out all the problem ingredients, like the wheat flour for the crust, we keep the tomato sauce, use a no-sugar-added tomato sauce. We use the cheese, organic cheese preferably. We use whatever else you want, green peppers, onions, etc., olive oil. You make a delicious pizza. That pizza is now a health food. It's good for you. And so you can have that pizza for breakfast. If you made it last night for dinner, save a few pieces for breakfast. And so there's lots and lots of possibilities, though it does require a difference in thinking about breakfast.
Now, you know, I noticed that many of your recipes contain almond flour. So what if you're allergic to almond flour? Or what if – can nuts make you fat if you have too many of them?
They can, because they can load up on the carbs, but it takes quite a bit to do that. So I'm very mindful of that. So when we use it, we can all the recipes that I have try to keep the carb ceiling at 15 grams net carbohydrates. Net carbohydrates meaning total carbohydrates minus fiber. So we try to stay below 15 grams net per serving, so that you can enjoy, say, a muffin made with almond flour and not worry about it. Now, I use almond flour just because it's among the more baking friendly. It's a little bit more forgiving, but there's lots of other options. Walnut, pecan make a pretty good flour. Ground golden flaxseed has some good properties. Coconut flour is very useful, but mostly as what I call a secondary flour, because if you use it as the only flour, it becomes very heavy and dry. So I use it as what I call a secondary flour. Let's say 4 cups maybe almond meal, quarter cup, half cup coconut flour, and it adds more structure. You know what makes a great flour? Buy your sesame seeds bulk. It makes an excellent flour. Sunflower seeds, if you grind it up yourself, it makes an excellent meal. Not really a flour. It's a heavier, denser, oilier type of thing. And don't use baking powder or baking soda, or else it'll turn green from the chlorophyll.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, green muffins, it's festive for Christmas anyway. So I think I already know the answer to this, given your philosophy, but what about artificial sweeteners? They did form a part of the Atkins diet because, you know, zero calories and no carbohydrates, they were okay. But you're not a big fan, I guess.
Well, you know, we had that one very well-done Israeli study, as you recall, that showed that aspartame, sucralose, and saccharin, oddly, even though they're unrelated compounds, all changed bowel flora and encouraged a diabetes type of situation. So those, I think, based on this one study, as well as plenty of anecdotal observations from people, including myself, by the way, I've had some weird experiences on the aspartame. There's something wrong with those three sweeteners. So we're left with what I would regard as some other sweeteners. We do avoid the most of the sugar alcohols, like maltitol, sorbitol, and mannitol.
Xylitol as well?
You know, xylitol is kind of in between. It's not as bad as those others. Mm-hmm. So the sorbitol and mannitol in particular cause lots of diarrhea, osmotic diarrhea.
And xylitol will eventually if you take enough.
Yes, it will, yeah. So we go light on xylitol. I do use a little bit because it's the only sweetener we have. One, it's natural, and two, it will glaze for you. So if you have a very specific recipe where you have to get a glaze out of it, you can use a little bit of xylitol. It's toxic to dogs, people should know. Your dog can't have it.
Yeah, good point. Right.
My three favorites, though, are stevia, monk fruit, and erythritol. Those are pretty benign. You know, just anecdotal, we don't have any data on bowel flora, But just anecdotally, I've never seen consistent adverse effects from these things, particularly from the stevia and monk fruit. They're very, very benign. We don't seem to see amplification of appetite. We don't seem to see a stall in weight loss or weight gain. They seem to be very, very benign sweeteners.
It seems that you've started with the premise of a no cereal diet, but you kind of had to work around to refine it with these decisions about which additional foods are helpful. This is not a diet that promotes ketosis, is it? It's not about ketosis. You're not aiming to put people into a fat utilization mode entirely, are you?
I think it's an option for people, but I don't think you have to be ketotic to have a lot of the benefits. But that being ketotic, some people do go that route and achieve further benefits. I should point out the reason why I introduced these sweeteners into my recipes. You know, up till a few years ago, I used to be very pure, and we said only real single ingredient foods, none of these recreated foods, etc. And what I saw happen, though, in real life patients in my practice was people would come back at holidays, or they'd come back after a weekend, they had a football party, or they had their kids or grandkids over for a birthday party, something like that. And they were so frustrated because they couldn't make a birthday cake for their grandson, or they couldn't participate in all the dishes at the holidays. And so what I did was I came up with recipes to recreate these common foods that were delicious and maintained, still adhered to this lifestyle. And I saw adherence to this improve dramatically because people realized, well, they could still sit down to Thanksgiving, for instance, and have gravy with their turkey. They could recreate mashed potatoes with mashed cauliflower. It's delicious. You could bread meats using these meals. You could make a cheesecake. You can recreate a pizza for that party on the weekend. And I saw that people were just so much happier and didn't get derailed by these celebrations or holidays.
And so you've got plenty of resources there. You have not just the original Wheat Belly book, but also Wheat Belly Cookbook, correct?
Yeah, there's a Wheat Belly Cookbook and a Wheat Belly 30-Minute Cookbook. And it was my way to help people stay on track. You know, whether we like it or not, we live in a world where there's holidays and social commitments, and this helps you stay. Because as you pointed out earlier, if you went back, say, to a conventional pizza for your son's party, or you had a piece of birthday cake, you could get quite sick, and it could last for days and sometimes weeks, and this is not worth it. But see, these are ways to recreate that pizza, birthday cake, or cheesecake, or whatever, and it's delicious. You can take part in whatever activity you're trying to put on, and there's no health price to pay.
I see you're not a fan of fructose, but what about fruit? Does fruit have a place in the Wheat Belly program?
Yeah, because we still maintain that carb limitation, the 15-gram net carb with fruit. Lots of good things in fruits, but they, as you know, they tend to load up on sugar. You can be quite diabetic eating lots of fruit. I've seen it happen many times. I'm sure you've seen it too. It's the fruit cannot dominate the diet, and you just can't get away with it. It just has too much sugar in it. Now, fructose, as you know, has a stealth type effect. Fructose does not raise blood sugar right away. It raises blood sugar many hours later. It has effects that are very delayed. Now, a lot of it's dose dependent, and it's not quite clear where the effects begin, because a lot of the studies that we have are artificial studies where the quantity of fructose is inflated to as much as 25% of total calories, which is an extraordinary amount. So it's not quite clear what the cutoff should be, but it is clear that fructose overconsumption, whether it's via high fructose corn syrup or honey or maple syrup or the fructose and sucrose, too much of that does have adverse consequences that are not immediately apparent through a blood sugar, for instance.
Mm-hmm. But more manifesting as high triglycerides.
Exactly. And I remind people, too, that there's a phenomenon called glycation, glucose modification of proteins that's irreversible and leads to cataracts, hypertension, heart disease, etc. There is a process also called fructation, which is fructose modification of proteins that's about 10 times worse than it is for glycation.
Wow. You know, there's this test, the fructosamine test. It's not done too commonly, but it's sort of a similar to the hemoglobin A1C. And that's an example of fructation, I guess, where the sugar binds to amines, which are constituents of protein, and that ain't good for the body, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? There are many ways in which our listeners can interact with you. You got tons of resources, so why don't you enumerate them?
Well, good places for people to start, or people just want to explore a little further, there's a Wheat Belly Facebook page. As with anything, when something gains a lot of ground, there's lots of fakes around. So it's called the official Wheat Belly Facebook page. You'll recognize it because, one, I'm on it. There's several hundred thousand people on there. So if you see a page with a couple hundred people, that's not a real page.
Okay.
There's also a Wheat Belly blog. It's very popular. A lot of the new ideas are there, a lot of advice on how to navigate bowel flora and vitamin D and new recipes all come up on the Wheat Belly blog. Those are the two best places to start.
And there's also community. People can kind of join a community of adherents to the Wheat Belly program, share experiences, query experts, correct?
Yes, absolutely. On both those places. There's also a book that just came out in the last 3 weeks or so called Wheat Belly 10-Day Grain Detox. Even though it's the fifth book in the series, it was my response to the people who said, I read the books, I still don't know what to do. So this is my effort to, as easily, concisely, and effectively as possible, give people a 10-day period. Here's a 10-day menu plan, day by day, meal by meal. Here's how you weave in the supplements. I try to make it as easy and step-by-step as possible. And that's been going just for a few weeks. We even have a private Facebook page to support that effort. And that's growing like crazy. People are liking this approach. Some, you know, lots of people want to know the science. Some don't. So this is for the people who say, yeah, I'll worry about the science later on. I just want to get started right as fast as I can. That's what this detox book is about.
Well, you're making it accessible at a lot of different levels. So it's an entry point for anyone. And you're really amplifying the work of a cardiologist by getting this information out to hundreds of thousands and millions of people. And I think really improving America's health. So congratulations to you for messaging this.
And to you as well.
Great stuff, as usual. Dr. William Davis, thank you very much for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.